and they wanted to interview me, which really surprised me because I'm not a famous person or anything like that. And I think it probably went back to how I had many years earlier at Berkeley gotten a degree in chemistry when, hardly anybody else like me was doing anything like that.
Welcome to the Raising the Steam podcast. I am your host, M. Ross. Today, I am here with a retired science educator and lifelong learner, Dr. Sandra Atkins. Dr. Atkins, how are you?
I'm just fine.
Awesome. Awesome. Could you tell us a bit more about yourself and your journey?
Oh, my. Okay. Well, I've lived for the past 40 years in northern New Jersey, just a few minutes from Manhattan. I was born in Winston-Salem, North Carolina in 1944, where I completed 12 years of schooling. And after that, in 1962, went to Howard University for a very good year, an eventful year. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, after 1 year, I transferred to the University of California at Berkeley. That is where I got my bachelor's degree in chemistry in 1967. And immediately I was employed in a cutting-edge science laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley. From there, I went to Florida State University and got a master's degree in chemistry with a minor in higher education in 1970. And for the next years, I had a great adventure. And I wasn't all by myself during that adventure, but I think that'll come in later. I had a short stint in industry, the electronics industry. But for 42 years, I was in science education in schools and colleges in Florida, Northern Virginia, Massachusetts, and finally in New Jersey. In New Jersey, that's where most of my adventure occurred. Yeah, actually, more than 40 years of adventures. I worked in a school district for 18 years, and I worked as a professor in a university for 14 years. I'm married. During almost all of my journey, it's a professional journey anyway, I've been married to Dr. Daniel Atkins. He is a scientist, and he has been a professor of chemistry. We have two daughters and two sons-in-law and four grandchildren. And among them, there are four engineers, and that makes it pretty exciting. But not only do we have four engineers among the adults in the family, there are two who hail from the performing arts. That's my second daughter and her husband. So that's pretty much what my life is like.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for that summary. So let's back up a little bit. You mentioned that you were originally from North Carolina. So you and I are both, we're both from North Carolina. You, as you said, from Winston-Salem. And my family's from Lumberton, North Carolina. And these are very different areas in terms of economics and culture. Can you talk about how your family and the environment you grew up in shaped your aspirations and career?
Oh, yes. I love to do that because I fortunately had a very, almost an advantaged early life. Even though I was born in 1944, my community and my home comprised together the best support that I can think of, even looking at it from the perspective of an educator who's seen so much. It was between the home, the schools, and the community. I had tremendous support, which endows me with a holistic foundation. Mm. I mean, from the emotional standpoint, self-esteem, lovely family, cohesive family, lots of relatives, to the outside community, which was church. Church was a central part of our lives, and the schools, excellent schools. So good that I was compelled to write about them.
Mm-hmm.
So I emerged from high school with the self-concept and an outlook, determined to go to college and major in chemistry. I already knew what I wanted to major in. And I wanted to become a scientist, and I thought I could do it, because there was nothing that I had encountered in my home community that would tell me otherwise.
That is awesome. You paint a beautiful picture, and you kind of alluded to the book that you wrote, and I have it actually right here. It's called A Journey in Learning and Teaching Science, with a subtitle, Winston-Salem, North Carolina is Where My Story Begins. Now, why was it important to you to write this book and to emphasize your origins in North Carolina?
Okay. There were many reasons. First of all, because I came through with a bachelor's degree in chemistry at one of the most prestigious universities, people began to ask me, especially around the 1980s or 1990s, how did you do that? Some people were incredulous. I mean, you know, they thought I didn't even have the background that my resume showed.
Right.
So there was always that need to try to explain how it happened. But to tell the truth, when they first asked me, all I could point, you know, all I could think was, well, I thought I could do it. You know, I really at that point didn't realize how special my upbringing was. Mm. And I went through years of thinking about writing a book. If I had written a book back in the 90s, it would have been all about science. But writing the book in, you know, actually in the past year, it had to be about my entire autobiography, because that my entire life, because that way it would kind of connect the dots and show that it was not only academics that was very important, but it was just a whole combination of things that really contributed to my success, to my achievements as a young person, and to my satisfaction in a whole life, now numbering 80 years. So I wanted also to pay tribute to the people, the institutions, and even the circumstances that drove me. I should say, was I driven? And I guess I was, to a point, driven to achieve. It was a happy and, for the most part, joyful experience. Because I really would have been enjoying this adventure, and it's been very fulfilling.
Awesome. And I've read your book, and I found it extremely inspiring and thought-provoking. One thing I learned about you in the book is that you've always had a passion for learning. Was that something you were just born with, or do you think that was due to your environment?
Well, I can't say that I was born with it, but I think it was a part of my cultural heritage.
Mm.
I learned from an early age about my family. My mom talked about her grandparents, and I was very much connected to my father's family because they lived in Winston-Salem. There was always a passion for achieving, for betterment. Mm. Now, my school experiences were wonderful. I just like to read. I like to do practically everything that they put before me, actually. So I guess it was a part of my personality. But also, I came along during the civil rights era. And at the age of 10, that was really the dawning of the civil rights era, I would say. And I learned about Brown versus the Board of Education. I mean, that's not what they were saying, but what they were saying, Thurgood Marshall had said, had gotten the Supreme Court to decide that segregation was not constitutional, really.
Right.
Now, that would be kind of hard for me to understand because I was a happy child. I had everything I needed. But just the idea that children might be learning more than I was learning, that kind of disturbed me.
Right.
And I knew, based on what everybody was saying, education is the pathway to equality. We didn't have equality. We were very aware of white supremacy, and the way to equality was considered to be education. So I had a doubled inspiration for learning. I wanted to learn because I liked it, but I thought it was my responsibility to learn and achieve.
Mm.
So there were many influences on my aspirations.
That's really interesting, the piece about the fact that you felt a responsibility to learn and achieve. And would you say that tapped into your actual passion for learning, or was that just fueled by curiosity, or and what's the mixture, if both?
Nobody ever had to make me learn anything. As I said, I love to read. I love music. And the opportunity was there. That's another thing, you know, the opportunity was there. So it was a part of my character.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a part of my environment. Being that, you know, I was encouraged to learn. My parents, you know, I can even remember as a child, the smiles on my mama's face and my father's face when I did well in school, and on my Sunday school teachers' faces, you know, they were pleased with me.
Mm.
And that encouraged me even more to learn. And as I said, with the civil rights movement, that encouraged me too.
Mm. And how important do you think a passion for learning is for success in something like STEM fields?
Oh, for STEM fields, it's very important because those are, and I don't mean to say they're more challenging than some other fields, but it is a challenge. I mean, it's not just enjoyment, it's study and it's working hard. And for a person to stick to it, I think they need a passion to learn. And just for continued success to maintain yourself in a career, you need that passion, I think. And also, it's passion and it's enjoying learning, actually kind of being stimulated by the challenge.
Mm. And so do you think a passion for learning can be sparked in people who currently don't have it?
I think it can be. It could be that they don't have it because they haven't yet been introduced to something
mm.
that sparks their curiosity or that resonates with them. It could be that they don't have, and I'm thinking of children now, maybe the esteem, self-esteem, or they don't feel safe and secure learning, because that takes, you know, learning is risk taking too. You have to put yourself out there. And
that's true.
Sometimes people don't feel, you know, secure in taking the risk of taking the chance, if I'm making myself clear. So I think it, a passion for learning can be inspired, if certain basic needs are first met, like a person feeling secure emotionally. And, of course they need to have nourishment and shelter and all of those things. Often people, you know, learning, the first inclination is to, you know, get food or shelter or whatever. So they're prerequisites to inspiring children to learn, making them feel safe, sparking their curiosity, connecting them with something that resonates with them, maybe culturally.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Now, you've said that you believe children should have diverse experiences to find their best path. Can you elaborate on why you believe that this is important?
I think I'm probably from my own experience. When I was growing up, nobody was saying, when I was a young girl, you should go into science or anything like that. I had I went to an unusual elementary school because we had very dedicated teachers. They were educated primarily at African American or historically Black colleges. They were culturally connected to my background because they lived in my neighborhood. And some of them actually had advanced degrees. Some of them had gone to Northern universities and gotten graduate degrees. So they clearly were bent on educating the whole child. Reading, writing, and arithmetic and penmanship, those were the basic subjects. But singing, music, dancing, all of that, the extra, like extracurricular activities, drama. I was exposed to drama and music early, very, very early. There was a time in, I think it was about fifth grade. Well, we had music from first grade through seventh grade. It was a part of the curriculum, you know, the humanities, those poems, poetry, all of that. And we had science. The school was located in a very beautiful area. It was in a park-like setting. There was a swimming pool. There was a recreation facility. There was just all we needed. Lots of woods. The school grounds. It was like a nature trail. So there was opportunity for, you know, educating the whole child. And in terms of music, by fifth grade, all the children at our school would walk up to the high school gymnasium and we would hear the Winston-Salem Symphony. And that was a yearly experience. I can remember in my music class when we learned all the instruments in the orchestra. And just to remember to relate to you a first grade experience. They were so special that I could actually remember them. Our theme for the year was about trains. Now we're learning all this music and doing all these things. And on top of all that, we're learning all about trains and who works on the train and what are the parts of the train. And we had a train station. And this is the other thing. Winston-Salem was a progressive town. We had a train station in the African-American community. Anybody who took the train, including Dwight Eisenhower, when he visited the city in 1952, had to come to that train station. If they were traveling by train, he might have been traveling by plane. But we had an airport, too. There was Smith Reynolds Airport. So, you know, we had a progressive city. And because of the economy, R.J. Reynolds' headquarters was there. We had advantages that children, all of, not all children in the country had, and certainly not all African American children. So just to reconnect about that train experience, we learned, you know, the songs, "I've Been Working on the Railroad." We knew people who worked on the railroad. The train station was in our community, as I said. We had banks during the year where we put our money. And at the end of the year, our culmination experience was to go to the train station and hand the right amount of money to the ticket agent, buy your ticket, and get on the train and ride the train from Winston-Salem to Walkertown. A round trip. We knew all about one-way tickets, round trip. Some things that I see and do today, I can flash back to when I first learned about it, like taking the FDR from New York, in New York, when we go to Brooklyn, I see the United Nations building. I learned about the United Nations when I was in seventh grade. I mean, and just taking, when I was going out to California, I took 3 ground trips and 1 air trip traveling to California. When I went by ground, when I hit those states, I took the northern route and the southern route. Those states that I passed through, I had learned about, I knew the names of from the time I was in elementary school. We had history. We had African, we had Black history. It's called Negro history then. But we learned about our history. We learned about our culture. We learned about people who were achievers. And there was no reason to think, as far as I was concerned, that I cannot achieve.
That's deep. I mean, you talked about the approach that was applied to you and your classmates on having a holistic education, and not just education, but almost a rearing within the actual school system. So it turns out, you know, fast forward a bit, one of your daughters, as you mentioned, became an engineer, who I think incorporates arts into her work somehow. And then another daughter who became a successful professional dancer. How important is it to you, or how important do you think it is to balance science with the arts?
Very important. Very important. There are some scientists I have known. There are some scientists who are also wonderful musicians. So, and there are some people in the arts who really haven't. They want to learn more about science. I think it's good for people in order to be responsible citizens, in order to find ways to enjoy life, whatever their field is, to have interdisciplinary experiences. The arts, the social sciences, the sciences, all of that builds. And for teaching, it's necessary. To be a good science teacher, from my experience, and to enjoy your teaching, it's very important to be able to relate science to other disciplines and vice versa.
So speaking of teaching, so a lot of or some people are saying that efforts in STEM-based programs for young people have been ineffective over the last few decades. Do you think it's important to continue having STEM programs for children and young adults?
Well, I think back to my experience, you wouldn't have called it a STEM experience, but while I was in high school, I was exposed to science, and not only science, I was in the Junior Engineers Club. I was doing science projects. My first science project as a ninth grader turned out to be inspiration for my pursuit in mm-hmm, science. Mm-hmm. So certainly, now if they didn't have that extra thing, that extracurricular activity, then I probably would not have been so inspired. I also attended a six-week science institute between my junior year and my senior year. Well, that would be kind of the equivalent of a STEM program. I mean, but it was way back in the day. But that also made an impact. At the end of my capstone science course was advanced placement chemistry, where they called it advanced chemistry because they weren't pushing so much to get that extra credit, you know, college credit. But it was advanced chemistry. It was my first experience in an interracial class. I was the only black kid in the class, and it turned out to be only about six kids. But there were kids taking biology. So you could think of that as being comparable to a STEM program.
Right.
You certainly do, I think, need to continue emphasizing science, but not at the expense of keeping from kids that holistic background.
Yes.
It would be a mistake to just, push for science or to try to push students into directions that may not be what they need. Now, they might attend the program. I had one of my daughters, both of my daughters went to what would be considered a STEM program. One knew almost right away, this is for me. The other one learned, she showed us that it was not for her. She already knew it was not for her, mm-hmm. but she went. So these programs, and depending on the intensity too, I think they are important. I think it's probably best when, you know, they kind of integrate, maybe somewhat interdisciplinary, or show those kids what that science is connected to.
Right, right.
But I think it is important, but that holistic background is most important, I think.
Mm. So in your book, you mentioned Mr. West, who's your algebra teacher in the ninth grade. Now, he seemed pretty tough. Can you talk about the pros and cons of his particular teaching approach?
He was tough. I might even say he was rough. he was intimidating, I have to say. But you know, Mr. West was a man who had been around for a long time, and we certainly thought Mr. West wanted the best for us. Matter of fact, I think he was even part of the guidance department, as well as kind of an administrator. He eventually became principal of the school.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a historic figure because there's a woman in Winston-Salem now who's about 104 years old. Mm. Mr. West had been her teacher.
Wow.
And Mr. West had been around when my oldest brother, my oldest cousin, everybody knew who Mr. West was. But when he came into that science, that math class, he meant business. Now, Mr. West would not have been a good teacher for kids who were afraid of math. Mr. West was the teacher for the 9-1 class, you know, and the kids who had already shown promise.
Okay.
So for
kind of equivalent to like an honors class or something like that today.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Because back then, you know, they were, the students were tracked academically starting with in about the sixth grade. That's when I got into that particular track. And I do in the book talk a lot about that. He was not, most people would say, oh, he's scaring kids away from math, but the kids were determined. If you went 9-1, you wanted to have all your courses, you know, you want to do well because those kids wanted to stay and be in 10-1 and 11-1. And I'm not saying that this is the best avenue now, but we were kids who could do it.
Mm-hmm.
So in my case, Mr. West's class was the class where I developed stamina, building stamina. That's what I always think of it as, building stamina. Being in that class showed me that I could do something that I wouldn't have thought that I could do. I never made less than an A in the class, but in the book, I talk about how I learned how to learn and how I really developed stamina taking that class. So the long and short of it, I would say in that time for those students, there was certainly a more positive effect because we were all determined to do well.
Mm-hmm. And you also talked about Mrs. Scales, your high school chemistry teacher in your book.
Yes.
So you ended up studying chemistry in college, like you mentioned. Now, how much of an effect did learning from and interacting with a woman as your chemistry teacher have on you?
Had a big effect because, you know, it was an example of how a woman could do chemistry. I knew African-American doctors. I knew women who had doctorates, who taught at the college, at least one or two. But Inez Scales was the first African-American woman in real life that she wore a white lab coat. And, you know, she knew chemistry. And so that I think had a big effect. Effect on me as well. And then, of course, I learned about the most best-known woman in science as a result of taking chemistry. Marie Curie had to be mentioned in my textbook, but I read all about Marie Curie in my extra reading. Nobody made me read about her. There was a book about scientists called Crucibles, and it was a high school teacher. It was a best-selling book, and they talked about the lives of chemists, the lives of physicists, and Crucibles was the one that I think I read about Marie Curie, and she was a very well-known woman, though not from my culture.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a very, to me, it was a romantic story, too, because she was married to a scientist, and together they got the Nobel Prize way back. I think she passed away around 1934. But definitely those women had an effect on me.
Hey, thank you so much for tuning in to Raising the Steam. If you're enjoying this conversation, make sure to subscribe wherever you're watching or listening, whether it's YouTube, your favorite podcast platform, or our website. Your subscription helps us keep bringing you insightful conversations about careers in STEM and STEAM and how people can accelerate their journeys in these fields. Don't forget to leave a review or comment to let us know what you think. Now let's get back to our guests. So Marie Curie was married to a scientist, and you also married a scientist.
Did that
play in the back in your mind as well?
Yep. Yep. I think it might have been in his mind, too, because
really?
He knew all about it. and that is that eventful that occurred at that eventful year. I think I mentioned that I spent only 1 year at Howard University, but it was a very productive, a very eventful year. I already knew when I started at Howard as a freshman. I was on the honors program, and it turned out that everybody had to do an honors project. Almost everybody was doing something in the humanities or social sciences or whatever. But I knew if I was going to do an honors project, it was going to be in science. And because I knew a number of people who had gone to Howard before I did, that was another influence on my aspirations. I knew people who had gone to Howard. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, you know, I was among people who were upperclassmen, and I could say, you know, I'm going to do a science project. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I definitely want to. Now, the school would have, in time, told me, oh, you need to talk to such and such person, but that's not the way it happened with me. I took the initiative because I felt comfortable. I was among students. You know, they were like mentors or role models. And I happened to be talking to, and I can remember his name, Major Gear. He was from Durham, North Carolina. And he was in the pre-med program. And I said, I want to do a science project. Don't know what I'm going to do, but I know I'm going to do a science project. I want to do something in chemistry. And he said, you should talk to my friend, Daniel Aikens. He's a chemistry and physics major. And I said, oh, really? He said, this is Daniel Aikens. Daniel was sitting right beside him in the cafeteria. And he was very quiet. And I think he was probably a little bit condescending because I was only a freshman and he was a senior. He was going to graduate that year. He said, how would you like to do something in X-ray crystallography? Well, let me tell you, when I did that science project in mm-hmm. ninth grade, which was to show the structure, crystalline structure of sodium chloride, I read beyond that. I learned about atoms and ions and crystalline structure, but I also learned that the reason they knew what the structure was like was through work in the field of X-ray crystallography. Mm-hmm. That was way beyond the scope of the project and beyond my understanding at the time. But I always wanted to know from ninth grade, my very first science project, what about X-ray crystallography? So this senior is telling me about, you know, how would you like to do a project in X-ray crystallography? And I said, I'd love to. So anyway, he walked me to the physics department and introduced me to the chair of the physics department, who was his professor. And the physics professor introduced me. He was the chair as well. He introduced me to Dr. Soen Singh, who was Indian, but he had been educated in Germany. And Dr. Singh mentored me through this X-ray crystallography project. And that was it. I knew from then, I already knew, but that was the beginning of my exposure to, you know, cutting edge science as a freshman in college, and really kind of a result of my ninth grade chemistry project.
Very cool. And this sort of came full circle, kind of how you were saying before.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, absolutely. I mean, you kind of alluded to some of your formal and informal mentors. Can you talk about the importance of both those formal and informal mentorship relationships in your career?
Okay. Now, when I was coming through, people weren't talking so much about mentors per se. I know when they began to be more concerned about the underrepresentation of women and minorities in the science fields, then it was reasonable that people needed to have mentors even after they got jobs to be able to, you know, kind of navigate all that they needed to in order to be successful, to remain successful. I did not have that kind of experience myself. But I guess informal mentoring was probably more important for me.
Mm-hmm.
When, as I was saying, you know, when I went to Howard, I was always, even in high school, looking at what the older kids were doing, looking at the real role models. And I had a pretty good relationship with students who were older than I was. And but it was informal. And because it was informal, I think I was more comfortable with them. And I can see that was very effective. You know, we probably even had more things in common as opposed to going into an organization and then there's somebody who has been specified to be your mentor. But I can see the importance of both. And I started talking. I don't know if I've answered the question that you asked me, actually. Which is more important? I think that both.
No, not which one is more important, but just the effect that they've had on you in your career and your life.
Mm-hmm. Most of the mentoring I have encountered has been informal. Now, in my job as a science education, as a person in science education, I have done some mentoring, but it has not, it's usually been, inspiring. Even as a supervisor of math, science, and technology, I took the approach of not just coming in and observing and critiquing, but talking about, and I was more like a team player or whatever. And that is a kind of mentoring. So I think it can take different forms, and I think it is very important.
So what are some of the challenges you faced along your journey, and how did you overcome some of those?
Okay. Well, I mentioned that my husband and I met in college. We've actually been married for almost 61 years.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. Now, my journey in science started when I was in college. We were married, and actually our first child was born 2 years before I got my bachelor's degree at Berkeley. So not only was that, a very challenging experience because the professors and the students were top notch, but I also had the family. Right. Family has been very important. So I in a way, the experience of family and career or family and studies, it posed a challenge. But on the other hand, it was also anchoring, and probably because my husband was also in science, I had somebody to talk to every day. You know, as a matter of fact, the first 5 years of our marriage, we went to the same place to study. And sometimes I'd be in the lab with him, sometimes overnight. And after the baby was born, we actually took our daughter to the lab. So that was an added responsibility. But on the other hand, it just inspired me more. So I really look at it all as they reinforced each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to do my work and live my family life so that it was kind of integrated, you know?
Right.
And when I was working, it was like almost seamless. That you used that word before. I don't know what when we were talking about something, but it was all related, and I was doubly inspired, you know, by the family.
Now, was that like by design, or is it just you made the best of the situation you were presented with? Like, did you apply engineering principles, so to speak, as you were kind of going through it, or you just did it the way it went?
You know, I'm going to tell you, and I think I mentioned it in my book, as far as family, and as far as sticking to the goal, I had my very best role models in people who had no science degree, people who didn't even have a college degree. They were my parents.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they did together.
Gotcha.
I saw how they worked on their goals. You know, I could wake up in the morning and hear them talking about what they were going to get done. They put a lot into our education. Both of them were very involved in our schools. My father was actually a PTA president. I just saw how two people put the most into their family, but they put it into their work too, and they did it at the same time. Matter of fact, they worked together in the laundry of the college that was in our black, historically black college. They met at that college and they worked together at that college. So they were going to work every day to the same place. And it was all so well connected. And I really believe, yeah, that's where my model came from. And you know, like Marie Curie and Pierre Curie, I know it may sound way out, but I had a vision of them working together in a dingy laboratory, though my parents worked together in a clean laundry. And I had a vision of her having two little girls underfoot while she was, now whether she had childcare or not, I you know, she had to have some part of the time. But the idea of, and the last chapter of my book is making a home, making a living, making a life.
Mm.
And it is all about us as scientists putting it all together and working it all together. And the whole time we were achieving in science or in science education, we were doing it for our family. We were doing it for ourselves and we were doing it for our family. So to answer your question, I never got the question quite that way, but I just believe that It was role model, role modeling that helped me in terms of putting, you know, the career and the family, all of that together. And my husband and I always try to, you know, inspire each other and be helpful to each other in the careers that we had.
Right.
And it was easy to do because, you know, we just happened to be in the same field, so to speak.
Now, what advice would you give to parents who have kids interested in STEM fields?
I would say that they should give their children as much opportunity as possible, whether they're taking advantage of school programs in the school or outside programs, you know, like summer camp or whatever. They can do it with STEMs, but don't keep them from learning holistically as well. They need to have a holistic foundation.
Very good.
And recognize that just because they're in STEMs doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to stay in STEMs. Yeah.
Now, what advice would you give to the new generation of science educators?
Well, you know, the new generation of science educators have so much more to deal with than I began to see it when I was working in the schools. I mean, there's so many problems with home environment and connections between the home and the school. But I would say that the new educators should also recognize that students who show promise in science, yes, they should have those opportunities, but just keep pay attention to the development of the whole person, because just a discipline or even intradisciplinary science is not the only thing that that people have to deal with. I mean, they have to deal with whole life.
Right.
So I think the mentoring and talking to each other, because teachers, I think more than any group of people, can easily get discouraged. So talking together, attending workshops that help you to deal with not only supporting the science development of the child, but just the whole child. I think that's important. Mm.
Now, I don't know if you've been kind of keeping up with the recent news around artificial intelligence and all the different effects it will have potentially. Now, how do you think artificial intelligence will affect science education in the future?
Oh, it can be kind of scary. I think I have visions of people possibly not just in science education, you know, in science fields, careers, perhaps claiming credit for science studies that were not really conducted, or manufacturing data or that kind of thing. There's so many problems that can arise. And unfortunately, I think until they do arise and it's publicized, we don't always have the legal guidelines or ethical guidelines for how artificial intelligence can be used. Like there was a time when people were scared of science, you know, they thought, oh, that's a bad thing. Science is going to do this or that, or it's, you know, but like anything else, it can be used for the good or it can be used for the bad. And I think, you know, when it comes to time when you get, I can imagine people getting this incredible paper that a student says that they have written, and maybe they didn't really write it, or they had access to artificial intelligence, or creating the image of a whole person, of a person who doesn't exist, or just so many dangers. Mm. So I have my concerns.
Interesting.
And it gets to be harder and harder to regulate these things. You know, it's like the technology is outdistancing the legal and ethical guidelines. I suppose I have to be kind of open-minded. That's one of my, you know, keep an open mind and try to keep a handle on it.
Now, in your book, you say, it is said that parents give their children roots and they give them wings. Can you elaborate on that?
Oh, my goodness. I know that statement. It's a popular statement, you know, but just thinking about how my parents gave to my family. And by the way, I have three siblings. We're all now octogenarians. There's one one person in her 70s and she's mid 70s. But we all have the same kind of outlook as far as how our parents reared us. They provided a safe, physically safe environment. They provided an environment where we felt emotionally safe. We could grow, we could thrive. And that to me is like providing roots They connected us to our cultural heritage through our families and just how they were connected to the community. And those are stabilizing influences. And so that's what I meant by roots. But the whole time we were developing holistically, you know, spiritually. I didn't talk too much about the church, but my parents were actually founding members of the church that we all attended.
Okay.
So we had, we were reared with a very spiritual background as well as, you know, all the education and all of that. So all of that to me is like giving children roots. But at the same time, that's exactly what we needed to soar. Mm.
So
we were given wings. Three of us kids left home when we were very young and did what we did out in the world. The oldest one stayed there in North Carolina. But every day we text every morning. Believe me, my oldest sibling is 86. And then the one before me is 80, 81, a little more than 81. And then me and my sister. So every morning we're texting and something can come up today. I mean, something in 2024. It can be something in current events. And one of us might say, you know what Mabel and Alexander would say about that.
Mm.
And they have been gone for years now. We still come back to our childhood home. It's still in the family. Our parents meant for us to come back and enjoy it. And as I said, I mean, I was born in the house when I was in Winston-Salem. It's been in the family for 80 years and we meet there, you know? So I think of them as giving us roots and giving us wings. And we all of us make sure that our children and our grandchildren are connected to where we come from. Mm. So that's pretty much what I meant about giving children roots and giving them wings. Amazing.
So based on your book, so you talked a lot about family and how that sort of anchored you and as you said, gave you wings. But based on your books, it looks like you and your family have built a circle of friends that are like-minded and oftentimes successful scientists and science educators like you and your husband. How important is one's circle of friends and associates in life?
Well, I think it is important in terms of, you know, furthering your career. However, I think it is important also to be able to connect with people across disciplines and across socioeconomic levels. That's a problem we have today when we look at the politics and everything that's going on. I think people are not connected and not talking. One reason I love to go back to North Carolina, and I go all the time. As a matter of fact, my husband and I have a second home in Winston-Salem. And every minute we get, I mean, we've traveled, we've been to China and been here and we've been there. But it's good to go back and relax when I can find my friends. And that's another thing about the book. The satisfaction it's brought is that there are still people in Winston-Salem who knew me when I was young. And they are saying, how do you remember this? How do you remember that? And one person even said, I thought you were stuck up. And a lot of them thought that I didn't have anything except science and learning in my mind. But obviously I was well connected. Because I remind them through my book of things that they've even forgotten. So I think that it's very important for people to be able to talk and connect across socioeconomic levels. Mm. And, you know, because I think classism has really been a detriment to people.
So, I mean, with that being said, how important are soft skills and networking and things just in life and also in career?
In careers, it's important because you're concerned about, succeeding in your career. Networking is important. But I'll be honest with you, I'm so glad that I held on to my roots throughout my life. Everywhere my husband and I were traveling, and we lived in different areas of the country. We worked up and down the East Coast from Florida all the way to Massachusetts. We've done a lot of traveling to science conventions in Europe and in China, but we always come back. We always come back, and as old people always told us, don't forget where you come from. So both are important, but for me, what sustained me is not forgetting where I came from and having a continuous connection with my roots.
So in your book, you also say you're not defeated until you defeat yourself. Can you talk about that a bit more?
Yeah, I thought about that. You know who really said that? That was not me. It was my brother, because in the bonus chapter, I share the stories shared to me by six individuals who came along when I came along, who went to school with me, who had also majored in science or had science careers. Now, one of them was my brother, who had a very different experience from mine, in that he went directly to work from school because he got married while he was still in high school. He and his high school sweetheart, they were expecting a little boy, but they weren't expecting a boy. But in those days, we didn't know what we were going to get, but they did get it. They had a beautiful baby boy, and it was necessary for him to find work right away. He was a part of the integrated industrial arts. He was very smart in science and math. He expected to get a job after high school, but it didn't work out. Obviously, it was discriminatory. So he had to go to New York to, and my grandmother, who's mentioned in the book, both my grandmothers are, had him to come to New York and look for a job. And he was beating down, sidewalks of New York, trying to get a job. And he tells the story, and it turns out very well. He talks about how my parents and my grandmother and my baby sister supported him through this ordeal. And that was his statement where he said that he had learned from mom and daddy that you're not beaten until you beat yourself. So that's, I wish I had said it, but I didn't say it. He said it.
Now, there's a great write-up about yourself on the History Makers website.
Oh,
Can you
yes.
tell us a bit about History Makers and about that write-up?
Oh, yes. About 12 years ago, I was contacted by the History Makers. I was still working as a professor, and I'd had this life. I was about to retire, actually. And they said that I had been recommended as a history maker, and they wanted to interview me, which really surprised me because I'm not a famous person or anything like that. And I think it probably went back to how I had, many years earlier at Berkeley, gotten a degree in chemistry when, hardly anybody else like me was doing anything like that. But the long and short of it is that the History Makers, that organization has compiled a huge collection of African American lives, and they did it by interviewing people. As a matter of fact, they came to me. They're in Chicago. They came to my house, and I sat probably in this very same chair in the same room, and a videographer accompanied the interviewer, And it was an intensive interview. It probably lasted 3 hours. So my life story, along with the life stories of I don't know how many African Americans, have been archived in the Library of Congress. And I should not just say have been, because they continue to collect these videotapes of interviews, so that the African American story is not lost in history, as it has for so many years. Mm. It is possible for students in school districts from or researchers to access those stories. They can go online and do it, or they can go to the Library of Congress and access them. So that's pretty much what they do, the history makers. Their mission is to make sure that American history, our history, is in American history, so to speak. That's my words, not their words. So
now looking back, knowing everything you know now, what advice would you give yourself if you could give yourself advice as a child?
Oh, my gracious. I think I would go back and tell a 14-year-old girl who feels so much responsibility to learn and enjoys learning and wants to always get it right the first time, that it's okay if you don't get it right the first time. You have your whole life ahead of you, and you're going to learn, but don't critique yourself so harshly, because I did do that. You know, I remember I wrote an editorial to the Winston-Salem Journal, and it was published in the paper. And after it was done, even though people were saying, oh, it's so nice, it's so nice, I looked at it and I didn't think it was good enough. And I actually hid it. I thought I had hidden it. I put it in a book, but my father kept it. And I didn't see it again for like maybe 40 years.
Wow.
But I have often, you know, just raised the bar for myself. And it's part of, I think, that African-American experience. You know, they often said, you know, you're going to have to be good. You're going to have to be twice as good, you know. So maybe I wouldn't judge myself so harshly, and I wouldn't feel like I would caution her. Don't feel like you have to get it right, all right, the first time. Mm. And if you make a mistake, it's okay.
Wow. Well, Dr. Hack, it's been amazing. Yeah. It's been really, really, really great speaking with you today. And congratulations to you on an amazing legacy, starting with your parents down to your grandchildren at this point. Very inspiring and remarkable story. And I appreciate you sharing all of this with me and with anyone listening. So before we go, though, could you please remind everyone where they can purchase your book, which I highly recommend?
It's available on Amazon. It is available at Barnes and Noble. And there are some other bookstores where it's carried. There is a bookstore, it's simply Best, I think is the name of it, in Queens, where they can pick up a copy. It's also going to be available at the Black Arts Festival in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It's the end of the month, every 2 years. There's a huge Black Arts Festival. It was started by Maya Angelou and Sidney Poitier. I don't know how many people are familiar with it, but I won't be there. I had hoped to be there, but it's going to be available there. And thanks for allowing me to let people know.
For sure. Now, if you had to summarize it, what would you say your book is about, and who would you say the book is for?
The book is my entire life story, and it's probably told in differently from most autobiographies. I believe it is good for, you know, I think, of course, I think my story is a good story. I think it would be interesting to young people, probably upper elementary through high school. I think it would be of interest to teachers, for sure. And I think it would be of general interest. I was looking just at something on the web, and I noticed that the School of Science and Math in it's in Durham, North Carolina.
It is, yeah.
Okay. There was a student, apparently they've made that book available online to the students. I would like more than anything for the book to be used in educational communities. I think a teacher training program could use it, as well as a science program, or just general life. You know, if someone was interested in an 80-year-old looking back on what's happened through the years, it's about much more than learning science and math. As a matter of fact, one of the things I talk about is my seventh grade history book. This is totally, totally relevant to what's happening right now in the United States. I won't say anything else, but just making the point that this book is relevant to life, not just learning and teaching science.
All right. Well, awesome. Well, thank you again, and take care, Dr. Atkins.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to Raising the Steam for more useful content. Leave a review or comment to help us grow and continue bringing you valuable interviews, resources, and events. I'm your host, Tim Ross. See you next time.